Monica Ferguson and Becca Brown. They came up with the brilliant idea for women's high heels to make sure they didn't sink into things or get caught in cracks and all that. And, you know, I know that, you know, the last wedding I went to in high heels, it was just terrible. But they're going to take us through the process, you know, the idea, getting it manufactured, designed, funding, you know. I think most of the people in this room have lots of ideas. And what's always tough is how do you go from that original idea through all the steps you need to actually get it out to a market. So I'm going to turn it over to them. We do have a mic if you need that, or just if you stand down here, I think everybody will be able to hear very well.
Yeah, great.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
It's all yours.
Thanks, everyone, for coming tonight. I'm Becca Brown.
I'm Monica Ferguson.
And we're thrilled to be here, especially amongst fellow inventors and entrepreneurs and those that support those communities. So we'd love to share our soulmate story with you and then make it as interactive as possible. We recognize that many of you are in the development phases, and we'd like to try to make this as constructive as possible. So we'd really love to take questions from you as we go through the story. But as John was so kind to introduce us, we saw a need for a specific product that would offer a solution to a very common and frustrating problem that we as women had experienced far too many times. For me, it was actually at my high school prom, way back when I was first wearing high heels and trying to take photos with my friends on my parents' lawn in front of the limousines, and we were all sinking into the grass, and it was very frustrating, and there was no solution. The only solution at the time was to stand on the steps and take the photos on the steps. And from that point forward, I remember just being so frustrated. Every time I would go to a wedding or a graduation or just outdoor party, I was always sinking into the grass. And it was frustrating. I was ruining a lot of high heels, but also I was distracted. I wasn't able to enjoy the party because I was like teetering on a rock or just sinking and feeling uncomfortable. So many years went by, and this frustration continued to confront me. And Monica and I had known each other from working together at Goldman Sachs, where we had joined right out of college. And we were friends, and we both ended up back at Columbia Business School together. And we were in a class called Entrepreneurial Finance, where the final for the class was to write a business plan. And so we started talking about various ideas, and I had just come back from a summer of a lot of weddings, and one in particular that was in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and it was like 4 days long, and I'd ruined every single pair of shoes I brought because every night there was a party out on a lawn. And so this problem was fresh in my mind, and I shared it with Monica, who had had similar experiences, and we said, that's it, we have to do this.
Yeah, we wrote the business plan, and it was so exciting writing this plan and realizing this doesn't exist, and if we could use it, there's a chance that someone else might want it too. But we really knew nothing about developing a product or retail or having our own business. So we started from the very basics of, okay, we need this made, and then we need to figure out who is actually going to buy it and how that process will take place. And so writing the business plan was kind of cathartic and necessary. And looking back at it, it was like something, you know, a five-year-old might have written because we were so out of touch with how things actually happened. But we had the general steps in place. But then we were still in school, we committed to going back to Goldman, so it kind of was put on a side burner, not quite a back burner, because we were so excited about it, but we had this other commitment that we had to fulfill. So we went back to Goldman, still with soulmates in the back of our minds, trying to figure out how to get this done. And we began cold calling engineers. Friends of friends referred us to people that they thought could be helpful, but no one really was. We went on a website called thomasnet.com, which we'd heard about from Donnie Deutsch's The Big Idea. And that proved to be really resourceful for us. And we just Googled, you know, looked up on Thomasnet engineers within 75 miles of New York City. And we would drive out to visit them. And, you know, we were in trailers in, like, back lots of, like, who knows where in Connecticut. We were in, like, in big engineering facilities. We did everything. And we ended up employing a couple of people, all the while still working at Goldman. You know, just on a consulting basis. We weren't spending a lot of money. We didn't have a lot of money to spend at the time. And then
we decided that we had to do this. If we didn't pursue this product and one day went into a store and saw something like this on a store shelf, we would never be able to live with that. So we knew we had to do it. And there was really no decision to be made then. And at that point, as Monica said, we had sort of the basis for the product development. Looking back, it was very early on.
Yes.
But I think in a way, when you're developing a product, a partial ignorance can be a blissful state, because it's quite overwhelming when you're sitting in front of so much that you don't know about how to get a product from point A to point Z, or let alone, you know, D. And so it was good timing that we didn't kind of see the process in its full capacity in front of us, because it might have been intimidating.
Yeah, it would have been discouraging.
Discouraging. But we had each other, and we were committed to pursuing this full time, so we quit our jobs. And the next day, we had meetings set up with some of these engineers. We had sort of a framework of when we wanted to get things done. And at that point in the year, it was January, and we wanted this product for the spring, because that's when weddings and parties start taking place in the Northeast.
And so we thought conservatively, we'd probably launch by March, quitting our jobs in January.
We didn't have a product yet. We had some prototypes. And the designs of the prototypes were very different than what it looks like now. And we have some samples we can pass around. But
we didn't have money. We didn't have a prototype. We didn't have a website. We did have a web address.
Right.
But
and we thought, oh yeah, this will take like 2 months, and we'll you know, hit our stride in the spring and summer, and everyone will know about us, because everyone has been looking for this. So needless to say, things do take a little longer than one might anticipate or hope, but it's all part of the learning process. And we've been lucky enough from day one to really have some great sort of supporters, advisors, and just other inventors and entrepreneurs who have supported us along the way, informally for the most part. Early on, we just started calling people and just kind of networking with those around us who may have had an invention or just knew of someone who did, and I think that was so helpful. And that's kind of the best thing about this organization as well, is that we all learn from one another. Because while Google is great and ThomasNet is fantastic, they're really the best knowledge can come from others who are going through the process and can give you specific advice relevant to your industry, your market. Yeah. And so that's where, you know, this all is very, very constructive.
But so upon quitting our jobs, we had a couple engineers still. We simultaneously did raise money from friends and friends of friends. We did that via just a private placement memorandum. It was a very modest amount. We had a great lawyer who was separate from our IP attorney, who helped us sort of structuring that. Again, even though we'd gone to business school and worked at Goldman, we had no idea how that was done, and we needed a lawyer to really walk us through the whole process. And he's proven to be like an invaluable part of our team, just as providing, you know, good advice all along the way. And then we simultaneously started building out a website. Again, a friend of a friend who was a freelance web designer was helping us, and he would come to us with questions, you know, who's going to be your gateway provider? You know, we have to Google gateway provider. Like, none of these things.
Credit card processing, whoever's mentioned that. I mean, it's these things as a consumer you take for granted. Having a barcode on a product, we're kind of like, oh, how do we do that?
Right. Packaging. Like, all these things that are you assume are just so easily done or not. But just, you know, asking lots of people lots of questions helps. And so it took until about July for us to have a working prototype. And between January and July, what had taken place was really two engineers, or one team of engineers and one solo engineer, were developing two different products. And it wasn't until, like, you know, 2 weeks before we launched that we decided on one instead of another, just for ease of mass manufacturing. And so we went with that design. We had
initial batches, and we can even talk through that. Just when you're dealing with injection molding, you have, in many cases, like a bridge tool before you invest in your full tool, because if there are any sort of kinks to work out, you need that sort of transition tool. So we went through that process and had some preliminary packaging that we used to basically beta launch in the summer. So it was about 6 months later.
Do you manufacture in China?
No, U.S.
Here?
Yeah.
And it's still his?
Yes.
We actually, we asked a friend we were talking to friends about what we were doing, and a friend of mine said, where are you getting it made? We're like, we don't know. And he said, I've got a friend who works in plastics banking. I'll ask him if he knows anyone in injection molding. And so he gave us the top 100 injection molders in North America. It's a list. It's like 5 pages. And we called them.
Every single one. I took 1 to 50. Monica took 51 to 100.
And around 98, they started caring. And we went and visited some. Through our engineers, we had other referrals. And we ended up with about a half a dozen different manufacturing facilities in this country that we visited. to see, you know, where the best fit was, because it was a combination of a personal relationship, because it was the crucial part of our project, or of our company, and, you know, and the economics of it. And we had ranges for molds that, you know, went from so inexpensive to, you know, over $100,000 and would take 9 months.
Right.
And so we, you know, thank God along the way, we were learning the vocabulary, learning the vernacular, to be able to speak with people in a way that, you know, didn't totally discredit us based on our backgrounds.
Right.
And we found a great partner in this country, and we've been with them ever since.
Yeah. And that whole process, I mean, that took a long time, and looking back on it, we feel, you know, things worked out very well, but when we were going through it, there were definitely times were frustrating, because reaching out to injection molders or just engineers who could kind of come to our level and understand the problem we were trying to solve.
Right.
And this is a women's high heel product. A lot of the engineers and injection molders we spoke with initially, this was not a goal or you know, a priority. They are focused on, you know, medical devices or large scale automobile devices and things like that. So just getting the right kind of person who would listen to the problem and help us come up with the optimal design that would not look hideous on a woman's high heel. Because again, this is, we're thinking about our end customer. So that whole process, it at times was frustrating, but we were so focused on getting this. We wanted this, and so we continue to persevere.
And the team that we've been working with, I mean, they sat with us in their facility for 4 hours,
yes,
just going over designs and, you know, giving us their thoughts, and it was so incredible. And we could, you know, compare that to another group of engineers who was disappointed that we didn't have time to go to lunch with them at Hooters. And like, these were real conversations we were having with people. Like, and people, like, you know, really didn't take us seriously, and then people took us very seriously. And so we, you know, we were sort of anticipating that, so it wasn't so, you know, shocking.
But. Right. And one thing, I guess, to note is that when you're going through something that is sort of foreign to you, and Monica talks about learning the language as we were going along, one thing is certain, and that's just always trust your instincts. And whether that's it with meeting with an injection molder or, you know, a new potential account, if you're sort of getting a funny vibe, and that's where it's great to have each other,
yeah,
we can kind of check in. Did that, you know, feel not quite right? And I think that that's something that as an inventor or an entrepreneur, because you're not part of like a real structure in a big company,
yeah,
it's really important to just pay attention to those instincts, because most of the time they're right.
Right. I mean, it's a horrible rule of thumb that we've come to use, is that when people say things like, trust me,
you should don't trust them. And there's really no such thing as, you know, the best, like, I can do all of these things and promise all these things. It's just unrealistic.
Yeah.
So, and that's something that, it's just the reality. And again, having a partner or just supporters who can kind of be with you throughout that is really important, because it can be daunting at times and frustrating. But if you have the goal in mind and then working backwards and developing a timeline, I think it becomes a little more manageable.
Yeah.
And it can be a daily thing, a weekly or monthly, you know, by July 1st, I want to have my first prototype. Just something that's tangible, because I think a lot of times when starting out, if you have a great idea, that's great, but it's kind of like, okay, what's step one?
Right.
Who do I call? What do I do?
And even in our business plan and through our early development, we assumed we would launch this product and it would be so incredibly wanted that we'd be getting calls from the biggest retailers in the country and we would just sell it to them. Like, we had no idea what the process was and how arduous it was and how really brutal it is dealing with retailers. We also completely undermined the importance of our website,
yes,
and how much volume that would do for us and how much money that would make for us and how easy that money was for us to earn.
Right.
And, you know, our business is really very different from the one that we initially thought we had. Well, we do have, you know, really strong retail distribution. That's taken a very long time. I mean, to get into DSW and David's Bridal, aside from, like, you know, begging and pleading with them early on and, like, driving down to Conshohocken in Pennsylvania and, like, bringing candy to their receptionist, like, literally.
multiple times.
Multiple times. Luckily, there's a candy shop around the corner. We were tested in their stores a year before we were rolled out to their stores.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, a 10-store rollout where they had, you know, 20 dozen pairs of soulmates, and that was going to dictate whether or not we were rolled out to all 315 stores.
Right.
So it was, you know, stressful, and there's very little you can do about it, and it went well, and then it's just silence. It's a huge company, and, like, the economy was so bad, and, you know, still pretty much is, that there's so much turnover in retail, and the buyer you were talking to is gone, and how did it go? Well, it went well, but now they're no longer here, and you're being shuffled from a different category, and all these things that you can't control, you have to be ready for.
Right.
And so, and because we knew nothing about retail, we didn't have that much of a disappointment, because it was sort of like, this is what retail is like.
Right, and we'll just try the next number. We'll just Google the next person and just see who we could get.
Can you explain a little bit? I mean, I can kind of see it from here, but what exactly? How does it fit on the shoe?
Well, it's a stretchy material. And it increases the surface area on the bottom of the heel, so it dissipates the pressure.
So we're both wearing them on our heels.
You're wearing them now?
Yeah. So I've got the black. We have the product in three sizes.
And it turned out I was right.
And it's a flexible
material.
So it adapts to some extent, John, to the diameter of the heel.
Right. I was wondering about that.
So I got to the point where X amount of, you can get this much flexion, this much durability into this product.
Have you seen it before?
No, I'm just figuring, I analyzed it as I'm looking at the three sizes.
So here,
did enough shoes.
Do you have various sizes?
So we do, and the sizes are for the diameter of the heel. So in general, a woman's high heel is thin. It's a narrow heel.
Right.
If the heel gets wide enough, it doesn't sink into the grass. And I guess one thing that we should say, just so the definition is out there, is the reason a high heel sinks into the grass is because there's so much pressure exerted on the small surface area of the heel. So we're basically solving a physics equation, which is to increase the surface area on the bottom of the heel, we're dissipating the pressure. So that pressure doesn't cause the base, the heel, to sink. And what that means is more enjoyment when you're at a party. But it was a process to go through and figuring out what the right design would be so that this product could accommodate different styles and shapes of heels, but also be small enough and not compromising to the aesthetics of a heel. And one of the first questions we get from people, is, aside from what does it look like and does it work, is will it affect the look of the shoe? And in grass, it's virtually invisible.
You can't see it now.
Well, and on our heels, yeah. And that's what's nice about it. And when we were first reaching out to engineers, we had some people that would present designs, and they were just really ugly because no one would ever put them on their shoes. So, and then another type of approach was something that looked nice, but it would cost like $10 to produce on a marginal basis. So that wasn't going to be feasible either. The retail price is $10 a pair. Yeah.
And it's, what does it cost you, about $150?
Less than, well, it's yeah.
it's got a healthy margin.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's great. Did you, I imagine, you guys were testers.
We were, yeah.
You were the test, because you have to put them on shoes and go out in the mud.
Right, yeah. Well, and material selection is also a part of this whole process because, again, for this, solving a specific physics equation, the material had to provide the properties we needed. So to be soft enough so that it could be put on easily, but yet firm enough so that it could withstand the pressure that the heel was going to place on the base.
It wouldn't damage the heel.
Right.
But we originally thought we had to put a plate inside the bottom of the heel, like bulletproof glass, to make it so strong, mm-hmm. not realizing that the design could support the nut strength.
Right.
It must also, help your balance. It does.
Well, this is something, talking about sort of the distribution and the market and as it grows when you get out there, is that there are additional benefits, and the grass is the primary because that's universal. And a lot of women don't want to wear wedges or flats if they're going to a wedding or a party. But added stability and comfort and just protection for everyday use, whether a woman is walking around in this campus or New York City.
I have a hard time wearing heels without them now.
I can see that.
Yes.
Do you only target market in one company because they're the biggest distribution company, is that why?
No. I mean, we had the same approach to any retailer that we could get access to.
Also, you weren't cornered into a market with this one 11 store.
No.
Okay.
We said, look, now we have this product. So we got to July, we beta launched, and then we said, great, now we're going to retail. So we just started compiling lists of stores where we thought this product would make sense. And this was at the very end of 2008. So had we known that we were really entering into the downturn of the economy, again, it may have been daunting, but we were somewhat naive. Oh, no, it's just a little, a bad quarter. So we just started putting together spreadsheets, and we made a list of all these stores, and we didn't know any buyers, but we just started Googling. We would guess email addresses.
And you can call the corporate headquarters and say, I'd like to speak with the accessories buyer or the shoe buyer, and most of the time they'll give you that person, and then you have 10 seconds to get their attention, and most of the time they're pretty nice if you get the human. You know, they'll speak with you, and then you can send them samples and, you know, start the dialogue. The challenge is just finding
the person.
The human.
Yeah.
Candy
first. Candy helps. Hey, look, that's candy something helps. That we learned early on. Candy, pizza, cupcakes, figuring out.
High-heeled shaped cookies.
Yes. Something to get people's attention, because everybody's busy, and every major decision maker is busy, so any
but
way to get their attention.
They're all people, and people like to be treated like people.
Mm-hmm. And also, when you have conviction about your product and you believe it should be at your store, it makes it an easier sell.
Right. I mean, how many do you sell a year now?
A lot.
We're in 2,000 stores. 2,000 stores. And about half of our business is off of our website, which, as Monica said, is great because it's where we sort of are building the brand. We've got the direct messaging with our customers. We're able to get feedback. And it's where, in many cases, people are learning about the product.
Yeah.
Before you started talking to the engineers, had you already filed provisional patent?
Yes. That's a really good question.
Very good question.
The first, before we even handed in our business plan to our professor, we filed the provisional patent.
And that's something that I'm sure a lot of people know, but you can do that, a layperson can file that. It doesn't have to require a lot of engineering jargon, things like that. If you have an idea for a product, you can go to the uspto.gov and just file a provisional patent. At the time, it cost maybe just over $100, and it was just a paragraph. We want to create a product that does this.
And it was a placeholder for us. And from that point, you know, the clock started, and you know, we meet in our minds, and as the legal world dictated, we had to have something filed before that time was up.
Did you include any claims in the provisional?
Not in the provisional, because we didn't even know what claims to refer to. But it was during that 1 year period when we were working with patent attorneys where we realized, yes, this is what a real patent application requires. And so for anybody who doesn't know, if you are filing for a patent, you need to reference prior art, because there is, I think, the belief that inventions sort of are cumulative and in many cases are built off of previous inventions. And so once you cite those, it's kind of like building a better mousetrap. Mm-hmm. As long as you are citing that there was a mousetrap and that you're building off of that, it'll just help with your application. Of course, there are instances where it's a completely new, like software, for instance, completely new idea, so there that may not be relevant. But again, solid patent attorneys will offer that, you know, guidance and advice and do their work.
So did you say you wear them all the time?
When we're wearing heels.
And because I could see it as a heel protector. Mm-hmm. I know that I've ruined a lot of heels just by driving.
Right.
Yes. And why do you wear it all the time? Because I'm confused with the message. You said that it's about the mud and the grass, and you wear it all the time.
Yes.
So is it more stable normally? Because that's one of the reasons I don't wear a lot of heels.
It does create more stability because it's like wearing a wider high heel.
The
reason that we target parties and events is because it's a more natural place for someone to be willing to put something on their high heel.
Uh-huh.
Like a woman's relationship with her shoes is very special.
Yes.
And so just to tell them they need to wear something that they haven't otherwise thought they needed is,
mm-hmm.
It's rolling a snowball uphill in the summer. Like it's just not, it's not easy to do. But if someone's going to be wearing heels and grass, it's, you know.
And you find that it's more, that it's a more stable walk, even walking anywhere.
Oh yeah.
Because it makes perfect sense, but.
Well, someone used a snowshoe metaphor earlier as a joke, but it's absolutely relevant.
Yeah.
It's like a mini snowshoe.
Oh, interesting.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I think she had her hand up first.
Before you guys decided to quit your jobs, how much money did you have, how many months' salaries did you have saved away?
Good question. We had a not insignificant amount, and at the time, coming out of business school with a lot of loans, you know, we had as much as we possibly could together. But it was under $100,000 of cash, but kind of in the $50,000 range is what we were sort of channeling into the business. And once we kind of hit that point, we exhausted our own reserves. So it took
like for your personal stuff, like your bills.
Well, that's what we saved before we left. Yeah, but then we realized, look, just get this started and invest in the tooling and the website and the packaging. we need outside capital. We don't have that capital. But
we were very poor for a very long time.
Yes.
I mean, not, we're not like rich now, but like, it was sacrifice and struggle. And
we didn't pay ourselves at all for really like
a
couple years, yeah.
Put everything back into the business.
Everything.
So then you had another job.
No. We just lived very simply. We had enough money to live.
Okay.
But not much more.
Yeah. And that's a reality, and there should be no illusions. You can't just sort of recklessly quit and not have a plan, and that's where having that plan, that timeline, and those sort of checkpoints is very important to keep your sanity and keep your life, really. So it's important.
Yeah.
Did you update your business plan routinely, and just as you went along, or just
We did. The private placement memorandum that we wrote when we first launched to raise a little bit of money helped us to, initially, or I guess, do our first revisions to the business plan. And then periodically, as we'd send an update to our investors, we'd sort of realign what was going to happen over the next 6-12 months.
Yeah.
And that was a healthy exercise for us.
Very. Because just as you plan, there are things and opportunities and new markets that come up that happen to be very significant. So
a real-time opportunity that's sort of happened to us is that about a year ago, we got a call from Veuve Clicquot, and they're a big sponsor of polo around the world. And they wanted soulmates that were orange in their Veuve Clicquot color with their logo on it. And so we developed this whole package for them that they used in New York and in Spain, and they're supposed to use in South America, but something happened. But either way, it opened up this huge world of corporate events and private label for us. And so we recently did an event in LA, this like big garden tour. This past weekend, Harvard partnered with us for the Harvard reunions, which was another big event for us. We're working with Saratoga Polo this summer, as well as probably Santa Barbara Polo, which is just pretty cool.
It's big horse races in France, like just sort of an endless opportunity.
Yeah, between the actual venues and the corporate sponsors of those events, there's sort of an endless world of people to work with.
Yeah.
Did you ladies ever consider licensing rather than going into this manufacturing? I think a lot of vendors need to understand that that's another option for them.
It's a very good point. We did. So licensing, if you obtain a patent, you are the owner of that, and one of the options that Mary's bringing up is you can license that, which is really kind of renting it to somebody that would apply it in sort of commercial use. So we came up with this idea. We got the patent. We could have approached, let's say, Dr. Scholl's or Nine West and said, we've got this idea. We'd like to license it to you. We didn't want to go in that direction. We considered it and considered, staying in our jobs and maybe just doing that. But we were so passionate about this product, and we saw how important it was and how needed it was in the market that we wanted to do it. We didn't want to just sort of collect checks from the concept of it. We were excited about launching this into the market and creating a business out of it.
Well, I think it's apparent that you women are very intelligent. You're working at Goldman Sachs. Even though you might talk about not understanding the ins and outs of starting a business, you have an innate knowledge of business and an intelligence that sets you ahead of a lot of people with ideas who don't know where to go with them. You don't say anything. I'm saying, I think a lot of people do make the mistake of saying, I'm going to go to a factory in China, and I'm going to do this, that, and the other thing. And you are business people. You are business people. Actually, before your idea people, you are business people.
Well, we just knew we had to make money every time one sold.
Right.
And the more money we could make each time one sold, the better off we'd be. But it was literally that simple.
And to go back to sort of that informal network that has just grown since we launched, we did meet with some people, actually toy developers, who that's what they do. They develop toys, they patent them, and they license them. And that's a great business. It's a great way. But we wouldn't have even known that that existed, that was an option, had we not spoken with them. So while we may have had sort of the form, like a business background, we worked at a company, we didn't have the practical knowledge about like starting a business and what these options would be. So I think just asking the questions and considering the options is something that's always valid, no matter what step along the way.
Yeah, Janice.
I have two questions for you. How key is it for you to have partnered with each other and keeping the momentum going? And secondly, I see you get a lot of press. How'd you do it?
The partnership has been completely crucial. I mean, it was very stressful, and it still is. But in the beginning, you know, you'd speak to like a, you know, a boyfriend or whoever, or like parents and friends, and they'd be like, "So how's it going?" And it'd be like, what got done today? And it's like, oh, like where do I begin? Like what got done today? Like you don't always have things to show for your work, which when you work at a traditional company, you're so used to having, you know, like, oh, you know, I got a bonus, like I got a diploma, like they're
miles. I was there today.
Right. I showed up at work today, did a big trade. Like all these things happen. But when you have your own business, like, I mean, there can be weeks when there's nothing that happens that you can explain to someone other than someone who's in it with you.
Right. Yeah.
So it, for us, especially in the beginning, it was crucial, but even as celebrating things that have, you know, been exciting for us, it's only Becca really understands how awesome some things are and how like awful other things are.
Yeah. It's so fun. I mean, where you can have a partner or have somebody that will support you, because it's an emotional roller coaster. And I think it's important to keep, you know, that passion going if you've got some supporters nearby. In terms of the press, thank you for noticing. It's great, but it's been primarily editorial. We didn't have backgrounds in marketing or PR, and we actually candidly didn't really know sort of how PR works and how one gets press. And the press that we've gotten, everything from Oprah to the Today Show to Glamour Magazine, has really been because an editor has gotten the products either by us sending her products just as a cold kind of send, or because she's used the product, he or she has used the product or seen the product and is excited enough to want to write about it and feature it.
When something is new, as our product was brand new, people want to write about it because it's new and different, and they need to fill, you know, wedding magazines and like fashion fix-it columns like all the time. There's only so much stuff they can write about and spin. So it was, we almost didn't appreciate how easy it was to get press in the very beginning. Now it's harder. We can still get it, but they want to see something different and new.
Right.
So do you have something different and new in the pipeline? Have you thought about that yet? Or still
there's stuff that we're working on, but not stuff that we're talking about. Because there's still a lot to do with Soulmates.
So you have a whole, do you still have a whole laundry list of how to continue to market?
Yes. So we're in the 2,000 stores, but there's still so many other places we should be in. And the fact that we've got the four colors and the three sizes, not all of the stores carry the full assortment. So there's a lot of growth to kind of move into just within this landscape.
What about international?
Yeah. International is a big opportunity. We ship to anywhere in the world off of our website. And I think just about every day we're shipping outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. So customers will pay $20, $30, $40 to ship a $10 product to anywhere, New Zealand, Serbia. But we also recognize that there will be benefits to having local distributors in non-U.S. markets, and so that's something that we're working on as we grow.
You can't just say somebody called up for 10. They must order like a gross of these things and just keep them.
Stores?
No, I guess a store, but an individual called your website. Say, well, I want to order something.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see somebody easily ordering, a 24.
Customers do. I think partially because of the nature of our being tied in with the bridal industry, or the wedding industry, I should say. When people spend money for weddings, they buy things in multiples. It's a phenomenon that like people see in jewelry and like bridesmaids' dresses and flowers and place cards, and soulmates fall into that as well.
I'm talking about somebody who has a great closet.
So they can have a great closet, or just someone is buying it for their whole wedding party or for every guest at their wedding. And so, you know, there are enough weddings that take place that like that alone could sustain us as a business. But we obviously are a little bit broader than that as well. But the multiple effect is cool. Because the average transaction size off our website used to be 3 pairs. Now it's close to 5.
And you can buy 1 pair if you want?
You can, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if you fast forward 5-10 years, where do you go from here? Sort of evolve into some sort of a lifestyle company, or do you plan to sort of have some kind of liquidity event to sort of move on?
You know, we're sort of open to anything. You know, like advice we were given very early on was someone said, you know, no one ever asked Fred Smith of FedEx what his exit strategy was, because he's never not been the CEO of FedEx. And so, you know, don't be too concerned with where it goes, how it ends. Just sort of, you know, keep it growing, and that's sort of what we're planning on doing.
I would assume it's a very seasonal business.
Is it summertime, outdoor?
There is seasonality to it, absolutely. I mean, the dead of winter, we've never had a day since we launched our site without sales.
Yeah.
but it certainly slows down in the dead of winter. What we have seen, and we've been pretty excited about, is that our season has extended year over year.
Yes.
So it might have, you know, the first year we didn't launch until July, and then maybe the second year picked up in June, and then in May, and this year was March. And we kind of died at the end of November. But we did have a few quiet months where, you know, you sort of sit around figuring out how to boom the next year.
And it's nice sort of to have that, but we also realize that once we sort of diversify globally, there will be a hedge built into that. So when it's wintertime in the Northeast, it's summertime in Australia. And that's just kind of a nice part of the business that we can have. Yeah.
Have you encountered any knockoffs? And if you have, do you have a strategy?
Yes, we have. We have encountered knockoffs. There, some products have come out in this country that are just not worth going after because they're, I mean, not to be rude, but they're just kind of stupid. But they don't have any sort of retail proliferation. They have a website and this thing that costs more and is unattractive. So we don't concern ourselves with it. But there was a case in Australia, actually, where someone had bought the product, set up manufactured elsewhere, and was selling it, again, for more money, which was, again, to clear.
They bought our product off our website.
But so, through our...
and they weren't even a good knockoff person. They just, like, changed their name. We found out what their name was, and we searched our records, and we saw, well, they ordered 3 months ago. How stupid could they be?
And so we have our patent, our IP attorney's office has an office down in Sydney, and they sent a cease and desist, and that was all it took in that case. But we do have the protection if we had to go further, which we were willing to do, just because it was, you know, unsettling seeing a replica.
So you have a patent in Australia?
We have global patent coverage of utility as well as design patent. Mm-hmm. And then we also have trademarks on Soulmates High Healer and some of our tag phrases.
Pretty good.
But you have to have solid IP counsel, because while we're scouring the universe to see if and when there are any sort of threats, we need, you know, professional support to be able to respond to those. So that's something that, you know, shouldn't be overlooked. Yeah, I think we started out with the mechanical approach, like we will sell this many units per month, therefore per year, and then we can grow because of X, Y, and Z. But like all, you know, projections, it was complete fantasy. And so we needed to operate in reality, which was, you know, we sold X. You know, that's 90% our target. but slowly and surely, like, that grew. But because you can't plan for the things you can't control.
Right.
One thing we were sure from the beginning, though, is that people liked the product.
Right.
And so once we knew they were actually buying it, a lot of the pre-launch stress had dissipated, because we knew, okay, if these 1,000 people are willing to buy it, that means there have got to be, you know, millions more.
Right.
And that just takes a long time to get the word out. I mean, thank God for the internet, because that certainly has like democratized the ability of entrepreneurs to get their voice out. And wedding blogs and shoe blogs and blogs of blogs. Like,
social media.
Social
Facebook,
media helps. Yeah, Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, we were very, you know, reluctant to get involved in Twitter until about, I don't know, a year and a half ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it's a part of what we do. It certainly doesn't drive our business, but, you know, you have to sort of have a foot in the game. And Facebook to talk to our customers. And we have a blog on our website that I think we're only the people that read, but it's there. And we try to keep it current.
Where are you guys from?
I'm from Greenwich.
And I'm from outside of Philadelphia originally, and I live in New York City.
Where are you based?
In Greenwich.
Cool.
Yeah. But I think it's a good point, and for those who have ideas but are sort of just questioning, is this a business or is this an idea? It's important to figure out what the market is, if it exists. If it's a really specific kind of niche-oriented product, just sizing that market, you know, the number of people that need this is probably in this range. And for us, because this is a new product, yes, it's correlated to the shoe industry as well as, you know, wedding industry and some other accessory sort of industries. We needed to build our market base, and we looked at it from a tops-down approach, which is just kind of sizing how big this market is and what percentage of that we think we could penetrate. But more practically and more realistically speaking is doing it from a bottoms-up,
right,
which is what Monica spoke about. So how many of these can we sell in a month? And then projecting that through various different sales channels.
And the reality of how many can we manufacture at a time, and
right,
how long will it take for us to get those, and how many can we afford to buy from a manufacturer at one time? I mean, they're the real constraints of the business. How much will the packaging cost? What is that lead time? How much can we store in this, you know, garage in the beginning? Like, where, you know, where is it going to go?
Yeah.
Like, we couldn't afford to buy, you know, 100,000 units of anything when we first launched. We were operating in very small quantities because we had to. Yes?
What is the minimum run that you have to commit to?
We tend now just to order in batches of 20,000.
I'm sorry, 10,000?
20,000.
But that's also driven by, you know, the tooling size, the number of cavities, so that's not a, really a static number. It's going to vary by manufacturer,
right,
by the material.
It's 20,000 pairs or 20,000 units? How does that work?
Pieces. So that's
pieces.
10,000 pairs.
10,000
pairs. Yeah, which is... That's a relatively small batch, again, compared to in the injection molding universe. Large corporations, just thinking about, you know, the company that makes this water bottle is probably doing batches of, you know, 500,000.
But our manufacturer is cooperative with us because we can order, you know, 100,000 units now and get them spaced out over time so that we're paying over time, so that we're not paying everything at once, which has been great for us.
Right.
And it's probably a little bit unique to the relationship we have with our manufacturer. But it's also something that speaks to when we launched the business, we couldn't afford to buy a bigger tool than a four-cavity tool, which is made two pairs at a time. But now we have three sizes, so we have three tools, but our volume is such that we need a bigger tool because the price point can drop precipitously. So one of the things we're investing in now is a larger tool so that we place our order, you know, we can order a higher volume at a lower price.
Also, okay.
Question over here?
Do you have... I think you were almost partially answering it. Do you have another manufacturer backed up in case you get an outrageous influx?
We don't.
No.
We don't have another manufacturer. It's something we're considering.
Yeah.
Maybe just moving our smaller tool to another facility. Just, you know, an act of God could,
right,
do something, and we could not afford to not have those tools.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a real-time question.
Right.
Did you have to give up a lot of equity to get investment?
We didn't.
Not a majority. I mean, we certainly, you know, had to give some up to have investors excited, but not a significant amount that would inhibit our excitement about pursuing this.
And that's one of the reasons we did not raise a ton of money. Like, we had specific uses for the cash that we raised because we didn't want to, you know, sell ourselves short.
Right.
What's the typical life cycle of the product, and is the material recyclable?
It's really kind of customer based, but when a woman is wearing the product at an event, say a wedding or a party, typically just sort of by habit, the person will probably not want to use them again because it's the end of the night, you're kind of just wrapping things up and it might not make sense to hold on to it, but we do package the product with a little tote. So if a person wants to use it for, you know, the next day or the next event, she certainly can.
A lot of people keep them on their shoes too. So then they always have them. You know, they're always on their gold party shoes, and every time they go to a party outside, they're prepared.
And it's interesting to touch on the previous point. We have a lot of customers that will wear them to the outdoor portion of the wedding, but then when they go inside for dancing, they realize that they have more stability and they'll keep the product on. So it's kind of up to the user.
Right.
But the material is quite durable, and the product can be rinsed off to the extent that it gets mud or grass on it.
Some people wash them in their dishwasher, we've been told. The black ones last pretty much forever. Because they don't show dirt, unfortunately. the clear ones, though, I mean, they get dirty. And so, I mean, some people might not notice how dirty they are because it's their own, but I tend to change mine frequently, but I have the luxury of
having a fresh pair of soulmates.
Semi-disposable.
Yeah, semi. I mean, again, it's sort of the usage of them. Like,
we had more stress reusable than disposable.
Yeah.
The device actually brings the heel up about an eighth of an inch. Looking at these, they seem to be about that. Does that create any controlling problems or footing problems with the front of the shoe? That is, it's changing the angle of the shoe slightly. Is that ever creating a problem?
No.
It's not.
On flat surfaces?
No,
hard surfaces.
Because your weight pushes down on the back of it.
Shoe usually has enough flexion to compensate.
It does. Yeah. You can't really detect it. And if anything, it just provides that much more comfort. So
we have so many, you know, brides who are wearing the product, and when you get a wedding dress tailored, I mean, it's precise with your shoes, and it's never caused an issue.
Never, never.
Does it make any sense to have a woman shoe manufacturer to buy from you so that they're selling the shoe and your product together? Mm-hmm. Is that being done? Or?
There's been some dialogue about that.
Yeah. So the product would come in the box.
Right.
Definitely.
Sounds like a good idea, one-stop shopping.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of repeat buy? I mean, is this something where somebody who buys wears it out? When you started talking about that getting dirty, but when you have the marketing expense of getting a customer, are you amortizing that in your plans? Are you amortizing that over the years by selling subsequent products, or is it a one-off kind of sale?
You know, we do have repeat customers.
Yeah.
You know, our data is still relatively new for us, but we know that we have repeat business from, you know, simply from like seeing names in our database that are repeated. but we also have because the age of people that are going to parties and weddings is always sort of new people. We have a very strong new customer. You know, I think like 85% of our website visitors are new.
Right. But the nice thing about the usage is that parties and weddings and events are happening all the time. And so a lot of our customers learn about the products through their friends. If they're at a wedding and they see someone wearing them, they'll learn about soulmates. And chances are they have a party or a wedding or something coming up where they'll need the product. And even if it is an existing customer, again, most women will have more than one formal event over the course of the year. So it's kind of, there's a built-in returning customer nature of the business, of the product.
Yes?
How do you do fulfillment?
The first, I would say, like, you know, 250,000 pairs, I think we physically packaged and sold ourselves. We have people that work for us now, and we have a warehouse attached to our office where there are people that are, you know, shipping and processing orders.
And this falls into the category of ignorance is bliss. Shipping to certain retailers, any retailer, typically requires a pretty long kind of process of requirements and special labeling and boxing and things like that. And as a consumer, you sort of take for granted that things just end up on shelves.
Yeah.
But there is a lot of back-end work that goes into signing up with a new retailer.
When we first launched, we used fulfillment centers because our initial orders were primarily off of our website. And so they would receive the orders, process batches, and ship them out. It was great, you know, hands off. But as we began to pick up retailers, because of how difficult it is and how many rules and regulations there are in shipping to retailers, I mean, literally, like, the David's Bridal Guide is about this thick. You know, half a page applies to us. You've got to go through it all to make sure what that information is and make sure you're abiding by it, or you get something called chargeback, which can, in some cases, offset the entire value of your order. And so once we had several retail chains, we could no longer rely on our fulfillment center because they weren't liable for chargebacks. And so when they would make human errors, we were suffering the consequences. It was a difficult decision for us because we never envisioned having a warehouse as part of our business. But we joked, you know, I think 2 years ago, Memorial Day weekend, we stood in my kitchen heat sealing 5,000 pairs of Soulmates for Duane Reade because it had to get done. And it was cheaper for us to do it than to pay other people to do it. Right. But at a certain volume, it becomes cheaper to have other people do it.
But it also is an opportunity because it's a customer service part of the business. So we're directly shipping and communicating with our customers. And that's something that I think for any company, like customer service is so important. And especially in sort of the internet landscape where our product is certainly not a commodity, it's unique, but yet people, you know, will kind of look around for ways where they can buy this. And so when we're providing great customer service directly off of our website, that's something that, you know, we take great pride in.
So lead time when shipping?
We process orders the day after we receive them.
So you don't rely on fulfillment center at all anymore?
No. We don't. Just to be clear, it was when I said it was cheaper to pay other people at this point, it was cheaper for us to pay other people like a minimum wage than it was to pay a fulfillment center to pay people minimum wage.
Right. Fulfillment centers are great, as Monica said, for certain, you know, for us, for that phase of our business growth, they were crucial because we needed the time to be able to call stores and try to get press and work on our website and packaging and learn what fulfillment's all about.
Yeah.
Again, that's something that, you know, that's crucial to the business. So
how many employees do you have?
We have three, and then us two.
Us two.
Have you done any price elasticity research? Meaning, if you, let's say you sold these at retail for $7.50 instead of $10, would you get enough more customers to say, well, maybe we'll warehouse them in, you know, Bridgeport or, you know, Iowa or, you know, and manufacture them in China? Have you done any of that? You know, it seems to me that it sounds like a good price point, $10.
Yeah.
Is, you know, have you done any research on a lower price point?
We really haven't. I mean, some off-market retailers sell at a lower price point because that's what they do, and they do not do any more volume than DSW did right on our website.
But some retailers sell it for more. And even when we were first figuring out pricing, we did some surveys and solicited feedback, and the value that a woman will put on this product varies.
Right.
Some people would pay $50 to protect their beautiful heels.
Or $800 shoes.
Right.
But an expensive pair of shoes is a very subjective term.
Right.
You know, we'll have people like blog about us on wedding sites and be like, I can't believe I just spent $100 on my wedding shoes. Like, oh my gosh, like they couldn't believe they could ever spend such money on a pair of shoes. Like, thank God I have Soulmates. It's insurance for my heels.
Right.
So $100 is a ton for some people and $1,000 is nothing. But
it's opportunity cost. So the cost of ruining your heels or if you're planning a wedding, just, you know, not being able to enjoy the day, a $10 price point is kind of, you know, not that huge of a...
Are you considering possibly lowering your manufacturing and inventory costs?
Well, we're lowering our manufacturing costs by having a bigger tool.
Mm-hmm.
And then, right, okay. For volume.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a standard markup, retail markup, where if it's $10, you're selling it
for
retail
for
$5?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If you grow, are you going to be coming to the decision that you need to bring in some serious capital to really ramp up? Or do you think you can finance through your cash flow?
We think we can finance through our cash flow. I mean, the structure, this again goes back to thinking about the business itself. The operating structure of the business is good, such that we can operate and generate cash, which we can then invest into the business. If we were selling like luxury items that had a really high cost of goods, it would be a different business model. But we've got a great margin structure right now, and as we invest further into our infrastructure, the scalability increases, so the larger tool leads to a lesser expensive cost per margin, per product. So we see that we'll be able to grow with our own cash flow.
Good.
Yeah.
I got a question.
Yes.
I think you just asked if you're consumers are going to pay $10, the retailers are going to pay $5. Did you just say that?
Yes.
Retail? All right. And then before you said the retailers books at this day,
The retailer book of instructions on how to ship.
It sounds like if you want your product out there on a, in a retail environment, which is obviously where you want your product, it's a hassle.
It is a hassle, and this is the thing. Like our first business plan, we figured, look, this is a retail business product. We just want to be in every store possible, but we sort of were overlooking the wholesale cost and then the fulfillment issue.
There's this acronym called EDI, which stands for Electronic Data
Interface.
And it's how retailers communicate with their suppliers. And, you know, I think like 20 years ago, people had to hire people whose job it was to be their EDI person. And they were literally like, you know, writing code just about for these companies. Now there are all these third parties that you pay very little to do, and they translate the code for you. The idea that it exists just speaks to sort of the arcane nature of retailers.
Right.
Like, they do not embrace the technology that exists to a point where it's a little bit startling, but it is what it is. Because we're, you know, victim to them. But it's much more challenging than we thought, but it's like one more process. You know, you get the shipping guide and you read it.
Figure it out.
And you rabbit ear the pages that are relevant, you make a summary of what you need to do to follow it, you explain that to someone else, and they do it.
Yeah. But having, building a website, I mean, that's takes time, but that's a, you can start selling products off of Amazon.
That's
yeah.
Do that for a living, but
yeah.
A real retailer, I mean, if I have 20, I expect to sell something for $20, the retailer is only going to pay 10.
Sometimes it
maybe,
only pay 10.
Maybe even less.
Sometimes 8.
Yeah. And there's a whole negotiation process that they'll go through.
And maybe they want 10% for marketing. If it's a big retail, it's like a big pharmacy, they might want stocking fees, which is something we've been very lucky to avoid. But we have other colleagues in other businesses who actually have paid retailers to give them shelf space. That's pretty much the market at, like, I think Target and Rite Aids and grocery stores. Like, that's how you get in.
Right.
We could never have afforded to do that, but that's how it works.
And then you're going to take 2% pay in 30 days or 60 days.
We have been lucky to get paid on time. Something, again, people told us we never would, but we do.
Yeah.
So, it's been good.
Yeah.
Can you pass around your package? Do you have a package?
Yeah, we think. Here, pass around a clamshell.
This is what it
looks like. The key is to invent something.
Small, lightweight, easy to ship. Yeah, yeah, it's true.
Shipping costs them.
It
yes.
does, yeah.
Yes.
And they're light and they're small. And
yes.
Just the packaging's great.
Oh, yes.
That's a big deal, packaging.
Packaging is a very big deal.
Yes.
Do you have
a
manufacturer in packaging in Connecticut or the States?
No. Nothing is in Connecticut, but everything's in the United States.
But no one facility is doing all of it, if that was part of your question.
Right.
So
clamshells come from one supplier, the paper insert comes from one supplier.
No, I figured
yeah,
that
okay.
out.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Well, we didn't.
And that all goes to your warehouse in Greenwich.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And then
separate.
The assembly is
all
done
separate.
In
the
Connecticut.
Assembly is done in
Greenwich. Yes?
Miss, do you like to extend? Because I saw. You can be billionaire in this area because you can extend to the man field.
Mm-hmm.
You can extend to the high technology.
Mm-hmm.
I have another idea to make, instead you step, you have a wheel, you can wireless communication, you can, this can be billion. You want that
to
later? Sure, yeah.
If someone ever asks you if you want to be a billionaire, you say yes.
We were joking that TV show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, at what point are they going to have to increase the millionaire to something
yes.
bigger? It's not significant.
One of our employees is going on the show, apparently.
Yeah.
Underpaid.
Any other questions? Yeah, Janice?
Have you ever thought of putting one of each size in a package?
Yes.
Yes.
We have, and we will. Especially because we're not in lots of high-end retailers. We're not in any like of the higher-end department stores. Something they need is a higher price point item. And so for us to have a higher price point, we need to sell more of them in the package. We have not developed the packaging yet, but we plan on it.
Yeah.
What each size was the question?
We have three sizes. So we initially launched with one size for heel width,
Yeah, so the height is the same, it's about an inch, and the base is also the same, it's about the size of a quarter.
Yeah.
But the opening at the top varies across the three sizes depending on the width of the heel.
Well, to piggyback that, what about multiple colors in one package?
Uh-huh.
Well, the black, silver, clear, and gold in one package would be another really good idea.
Yeah.
And the reason we haven't come out with, like, you know, blues and browns and grays is because, like, the Pantones are so specific that it's really not necessary for us to try to match them.
Right.
The clear really works. The black looks amazing on black. And silver and gold are just kind of playful.
And of course, for bar mitzvahs, we have ones in flesh.
Yeah.
I think you've exhausted everybody.
Okay, well.
Hopefully that's good.
Yeah. That was great, because that is the process.
It is.
Everybody's got to go through with the product.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff. The next meeting, June 26th, the CEO of Connecticut Technology Council. You guys might want to put that in your calendar. On the website for IACT, inventus.org, we now have a PayPal link, so some of you people can actually join and pay. And after this, we usually wind up down at Archie Moore's in the center of Fairfield for some libations to quench your thirst after all those questions. Is there any other business that we need to conduct? Any other questions?
Is that meeting going to be here or over there?
I think it's here, but I didn't verify that, so check the website.